Thanks very much, Campbell. Those of you who have sharp eyes may notice I have a mini MP3 player here that is taping this lecture. The sound quality is quite good. I've been taping some of my lectures at Warwick and then circulating them to students, and hopefully if this turns out okay, there will be a WAVE version that will be online, so if, you know, if you didn't feel your questions were answered adequately the first time, you'll have be able to have a second shot, perhaps. The paper that I've circulated, in a way, is a very sort of large omnibus paper that was commissioned by UNESCO for a forum that they're holding in December in Paris on the future of higher education around the world, in particular the governance of universities. This is a topic that has increasingly engaged me, and I obviously don't plan to read this paper or even talk about most of it, but in a sense what I want to illustrate here is how I come to the sort of position I come to now, which you might say in a sort of tabloid version is a sort of strong defense of a fairly classical notion of the university. Okay. As Campbell introduced me, my work is primarily in this area I've sort of carved out called social epistemology, which brings together stuff from philosophy, which is where I was initially trained as a sort of philosopher of science, with history and sociology of science. And these fields traditionally don't sit very well together in the sense that history and sociology of science, especially increasingly in recent years, have primarily played the role of demystifying, deconstructing a lot of the sort of normative standards that philosophers have put forward through the ages, which scientists often take themselves as their own self-representations, right? Certain conceptions of rationality, progress, objectivity, truth, stuff like that. So there is a kind of natural sort of antagonism between these fields, but my own view about this was that there's a sense in which there's still a normative question to be asked, namely, once you have deconstructed and demystified sort of traditional conceptions of what knowledge and reason are, where do we go from there? Okay, and in a way, the way I conceptualize this problem is in a way very much like the problem that was facing the critical historical theologians once they started to demystify the Bible, right, in the Enlightenment period and in the early 19th century. Those of you who know about Marx's early development in the German ideology, these are the people, right, who in a way inspire Marx in terms of thinking about what the role of critical reason is and so forth, because the generation before him were basically, the radicals were the ones who were demystifying the Bible, providing naturalistic, sociological readings of what's going on, and were having a lot of very kind of radical effects on the legitimacy of church and so forth. Very much like those of you who follow science studies today know there's these science wars going on where the sociology of science is in a sense seen as somehow delegitimating science. Well, it seems to me that what's happening now is very similar to what was happening in Germany, let's say 1830s, 1840s, during the formative period of Karl Marx. And so there's this question, though, where do we go from there? And one of the lessons of the German ideology was that these guys who were the critics didn't really have a clue. Right, in a sense, they sort of expected the church would sort of recompose itself, reconstitute itself, and everything would go on in this kind of enlightened state. Right, but that's not quite what happened, and in fact, it was a period of repression in Germany, and it was one of the things that made it impossible for Karl Marx to pursue an academic career, because you started basically getting religious loyalty oaths in Germany that you didn't have before. So kind of it was a reaction, right, that took place. So, I mean, you know, one tries to learn from history and all this, and it seems to me that it is incumbent upon critics, ultimately, to try to think about, well, how are we going to come up with some sort of constructive proposal that is, in a sense, true to the sort of criticism and the demystifications that we're doing, but at the same time, since we're all sort of in the knowledge business, we're trying to sort of take this forward, okay? And one of the basic moves that I made, which is a very obvious move, is in a sense that you have to start thinking seriously about what the vehicles of knowledge production and distribution are. So it's really not enough just to talk about science as such, or reason as such, or knowledge as such, as if they were some sort of disembodied sets of propositions. Moreover, I would even say it's not enough just to talk about particular practices or techniques, which is a very sort of fashionable way of going these days, right, where basically science is the sum of everything that happens in a laboratory, right? And I think that there's more to it than that. One has to talk about issues of institutionalization, right? Because one of the things that makes any kind of form of knowledge a true form of knowledge, that is to say something that has a kind of authority and legitimacy beyond the site where the knowledge is produced, beyond the laboratory, right, is the fact that there is some mechanism of reproduction, right, that there is some kind of regular way of spreading this stuff around to other places, in particular places that aren't involved in the production in any kind of first-hand way. Now, what I'm sort of moving toward here, obviously, and this is something that, you know, over the years becomes clearer and clearer to me, is that there is a sense in which something like teaching is a very important function here in terms of knowledge, right? And the relationship between research and teaching, right? Where, you know, research may happen in many different locations, right? And the university is certainly not a privileged location with regard to where original knowledge is produced. That's for sure, okay? But then there's the issue of how this knowledge gets reproduced and distributed so that more and more people can, in fact, have access to it and do whatever they're going to do with it. And there you do need some sort of centralizing institutions, which universities, of course, historically, are the most important ones. And this has a lot to do, then, with this idea of the classical university as the place for the unity of teaching and research. Okay, so this is kind of over the years, in a sense, is sort of how my thinking has sort of moved along these lines. Now, let me give you a sense of what I take to be sort of the countercurrents, the things that, because universities are not very popular things to defend these days, especially in the classical model. When people defend universities nowadays, it is as multi-service providers, right? So the idea of the university as a kind of autonomous institution with its own sense of integrity that goes beyond just satisfying a bunch of clients, right, that's sort of lost, okay? The way this gets lost, it happens at lots of different levels. Of course, it actually happens at a kind of brute institutional levels as universities are being pulled in many different directions. And you can see, even on a given university campus, there's, you might say, the phenomenon of uneven development, right? Where, you know, certain, like business schools, buildings are all over the place, right? Other parts of the university are starving, right, and have to move to closer quarters. That, in a sense, sort of symbolizes, right, the idea that the university is really not in control of its own show, in the sense that, you know, it's being pulled apart, certain areas growing massively, other areas kind of shrinking and curtailing, okay? And this is quite an interesting point in its own right, because if you go back to the debates in the 19th century about the siting of laboratories on university campuses, right, and I'm not talking about the polytechnics, of course, which were always homes to universities, but, you know, the proper universities like the Oxfords and Cambridges and Harvards and places like that, there was always a big debate going on about what this was going to do to the overall structure of the campus. Right? Like, was it going to smell up the place? Serious issue if you've got chemistry on board. And so there was this kind of conception that the integrity of the university, right, it has to be embodied in the physical space in an appropriate way so it looks like an integral place, not just some sprawling mass like Los Angeles or something. But, of course, universities have turned into Los Angeles, right? So campuses are kind of spread out in many different bits. It grows anywhere it can grow into, like an amoeba, right? And from the 19th century standpoint, that would have been a nightmare, right? That would have shown that there's some kind of loss of control over the situation, all right? Now, again, polytechnics were different. They had no problem with the fragmented campus. They were often citing their own facilities, you know, where the factories already were, or where the farms already were, or the mines already were. That, you know, in America, you may know about the extension colleges, which is where the origin of the polytechnics in the U.S. came from, where state legislatures would deliberately put campuses in the middle of nowhere so that they could sort of spread out and kind of, in a way, govern the place, giving it a certain kind of structure and civility would otherwise lack. So this idea of having universities moving around like that, that wasn't a problem in some context, but not in the sort of classical context, where you want to really see how it all adds up, how does it form a whole. Well, this whole way of thinking about things really starts to get lost with the end of the Cold War. And I would say I put my finger on that period. I mean, there are a lot of periods I suppose one might nominate. But one of the things that was very important about the Cold War, and generally speaking, very much true about periods where nations feel that they're in states of permanent emergency, to use this expression of Baron von Moltke, which became very popular in the Cold War, right? The idea is that the nation always has to be prepared. It has to be prepared at many different levels, not only in terms of having, you know, appropriate missile systems in place, but also in terms of the population being suitably educated at the various levels at which they need to be educated. And this is not just from a technical standpoint, though of course you want that as well, but it's also from the standpoint of people having a very good ideological sense of what they stand for. What's, you know, why are we fighting for this country anyway, right? These guys look like they have some big guns. Why are we fighting them? Right? I mean, that whole business of reproducing a kind of consolidated national identity at many different levels, universities have been historically very, very much involved. You know, it's part of the sort of nation-building activity of universities, and it's not by accident that, of course, universities really start to proliferate in the 19th century precisely in terms of providing that kind of infrastructure for the nation-state. And I'm not just talking about the natural sciences, which are relative latecomers to universities. But even if we're talking about the humanities and the emerging social sciences, that's primarily what I'm talking about, where you have this kind of very clear sense of what this country stands for, what is its traditions. You start developing canons, right, of what, where we came from. You get authorized histories. You get scholars who are sort of in the business of entrenching these authorized histories with, you know, very particular research. And this was certainly the German model, and the French picked it up, and somewhat later the British did. And America, of course, picked this up. So this is so there's a sense in which the consolidation of the university as this kind of base where there's a kind of integral form of knowledge that is going to be reproduced through the populace has historically been very much tied to the sort of national security issue. But let's say that's not the primary issue. Now, we may be getting, you know, with all this war on terrorism, we may be getting back to this again. But certainly there was a period with the fall of the Berlin Wall until, let's say, 9/11, right, where it looked like all of that was kind of disappearing. And certainly we're still ideologically living in that kind of neoliberal phase. And what happens then is this whole idea of having an institution like the university, where all the knowledge is somehow consolidated and reproduced to the society at large, seems sort of a bit inefficient. Because one starts saying, look, there are many different kinds of knowledge depending upon what you're trying to do with your life. And so you're no longer thinking about people as having in common, let's say, some common stake in the future of the country. Rather, you're thinking of people as people who are going to be doing different things in different sectors of society, getting different jobs, you know, maybe pushing the economy along, but in quite various ways. And so that the idea that we need to have some kind of consolidated knowledge place all located in one bunch of people who are then reproducing it to society at large, that's not at all clear anymore. It might be better just to have multiple types of institutions, each of which train people in the appropriate kinds of ways for the kinds of jobs they're going to get or likely to get, produce the kind of research, not that's, you know, contributing to some sort of overall knowledge base like a discipline, but rather, you know, contributing to whomever, you know, to the interest of whomever's paying for it. And we start going down the route of intellectual property and science parks and stuff like that. So, well, we imagine then, after the Cold War, and I think, you know, as it were, the ideology talks this way, a kind of fragmentation, right, dispersion. I suppose there are all kinds of euphemistic ways of talking about this. I tend to think about this very negatively, but there are positive ways, efflorescence, perhaps, right, of different kinds of institutions, different kinds of strategies for producing knowledge, different sites where knowledge is produced, and so forth. And it just sort of grows outward and outward and outward. And of course, certain kinds of evolutionary models contribute to this as well, so there's a lot of abstract theorizing that sort of is on the back of this, right? And of course, you know, in terms of, you know, the politics of this, it's iffy in the sense that, you know, there's something for everyone here, right? Left and right. Of course, you know, a lot of postmodernism. Postmodernism is in fact historically very closely tied to this phenomenon. So if you look at The Postmodern Condition by Lyotard, right, this is basically this book, you know, which published in 1979, right, as a report on the state of knowledge to the Higher Education Council of Quebec.
Here's Leotard, big French professor, talking to the colonials, basically, right? And what he's doing is basically saying, look, the idea of the university as a place where knowledge is produced and consolidated and is in some way a symbol of what knowledge is about is a complete myth. And in particular, the way the report is presented, now we think of postmodernism in many different forms, but the original form in which it appeared was kind of like a white paper. The postmodern condition is like a glorified white paper telling you all about the developments in knowledge in the 20th century and how people like Habermas and all these other social theorists who are still thinking in terms of transcendental ideas of reason have just got it wrong. That they're just so empirically off base that if their ideas were actually put into effect, they would be authoritarian because they basically stop the knowledge from coming from all these different directions that they're coming from. And what Leotard is referring to here, and he's of course correct in the history, right, is the fact that a lot of the fields that are very important, both intellectually and economically as well, so we're talking about molecular biology, artificial intelligence, information science, cybernetics, all these kinds of fields that are very much part of the 20th century landscape. They all started outside the universities or with some kind of external incentive. So maybe a university-industry relation, which was very common in Germany, let's say, in the beginning of the 20th century. But for the most part, universities are Johnny-come-latelys and typically resistant to these kinds of fields. Okay, and one of the ways in which you can see this, and again, it's another point Leotard makes, and it's one that's been repeated again, is look at these fields. They're interdisciplinary. Right? They don't fit into the normal boxes of university life because, as we know, universities are bureaucracies, if nothing else, and if you can't fit your research agenda into something, and then this is, again, historically true, if you can't get the research agenda into the teaching agenda, right, then there's no place for you. This is historically the way it was before academics started to get large extramural grants. But if you're talking about the beginning of the 20th century, certainly, one of the reasons why academics left universities and started working in places like Bell Labs in New Jersey, right, and Xerox Park and all these places, is because if you look at the life of an academic back then, they were basically getting paid to teach loads of courses that were reproducing, right, curricula, and teaching, for the most part, very elite people. Right, and they were still teaching them Latin and Greek and all the rest of it. And so that even in fields that, you know, found places in universities, like let's say psychology, right, where they actually set up psychology labs in university campuses by the end of the 19th century, the professors who were involved in all this had the students do the research in the labs because the professor himself was making his money by lecturing in philosophy. Right? So the psychology department, the psychology lab is located in the philosophy department. And it's considered kind of a luxury item because what's really paying the bills is the professor going out in front and doing the philosophy lecture. Now, of course, it wasn't quite so schizophrenic because, you know, what are they doing in the psychology lab? They're studying empirically the nature of the mind. And, of course, in philosophy, that's a big preoccupation historically. And so the professor can kind of show, you know, can in a way kind of help to legitimate what he's doing in the lab by, as it were, taking it as a kind of interpretation. You know, so John Locke thought about, you know, that we have a blank slate for a mind. Well, now I'm going to test this hypothesis in the lab. Something like that, you see. And that was very much part of how you legitimated the research stuff. But the point is, you have to get it clear what's the dog and what's the tail here. The teaching aspect was really leading everything, and the research had to be justified in terms of that. And for people who considered themselves very innovative and very much on top of the scene, you know, and that this was just backward. And so this is why they left the universities and started going into all these places that are now the progenitors of the science parks and things like that. Okay, so Leotard was clued into all this in 1979. He knew enough about the early history of the 20th century to know about all this. And so his big, you know, if you read the introduction to that book, The Postmodern Condition, one of the things that he says is, you know, he's perfectly happy, and he's a philosopher, right? He's perfectly happy to be in the philosophy institute that he's in. Because the way, France, as a system of higher education, you might say, is an ideal place to observe the kind of thing he's talking about. Because from the time of Napoleon onward, and this is, again gives you a sense of something, the way the Enlightenment's legacy, because you should never assume that universities sort of have developed the same way everywhere. I mean, I think in the modern period, when one wants to talk about the university in its best possible light, like I like to do, for example, one likes to look at Germany because there's the unity of teaching and research, there's this very strong knowledge base that becomes the basis of a national identity, which by the end of the 19th century makes it the premier scientific power in the world. And if you think about what Germany was like in the beginning of the 19th century, it was just some sort of glorified, you know, cow patch, basically, right? But by the end of the 19th century, it's the most scientifically powerful country in the world, and the universities are obviously very strongly implicated in this. And that's and the United States kind of picked up on this by the end of the 19th century. And so if you want to tell a nice story about the university, about the unity of teaching and research, you tell it through Germany. If you want to tell the bad story, you tell it through France. Because the Enlightenment as a philosophical movement, if you go back to the 18th century, which is, of course, a largely French thing, what are these guys like Voltaire, Rousseau, Diderot, what are they all against? They're against the universities, too, just like Lyotard is, right? This is why when we talk about being anti-Enlightenment, sometimes I wonder whether people know what they're talking about, because the Enlightenment plays a very funny role in all this, because there's a sense in which, if you look at the politics of the people of the Enlightenment in the 18th century, they're just as anti-university as Lyotard is, and as the people who now consider themselves progressive are now. Because they see the universities in the 18th century as this place where theologians go to, right, that reproduces traditional knowledge, you know, and all the action is happening elsewhere. It's happening in the Royal Society, right, which is an autonomously chartered scientific body. It's happening, you know, at the Académie des Savants in Paris. It's happening in the sort of imitations of it that these Enlightenment guys are trying to create in places like Berlin and St. Petersburg and so forth. So there's a very strong distinction here between what a university does and what some kind of research unit or academy does. And this is something that when Napoleon came into power, he institutionalized in a big way, and it still remains that to be the case. So that when you look at French academics today, right, they typically have multiple affiliations, right? They teach at one place, you know, University of Paris, 12,000, right? And they also have a membership in some, you know, école, you know, some kind of institute or something, institute of advanced studies. And that's where the research is happening, and that's where the primary affiliation is. And what they're doing in the classroom is just this routine rote stuff. So there's this kind of schizophrenic existence that the French academic typically lives under, okay? Now, Lyotard is an example of just such a guy, okay? And so he's putting his cards on the table of what his real affiliations are. And he thinks, look, universities, they're just teaching mills, get rid of them, they're not doing anything. But what really matters are these institutes. This is where the action is, right? And you don't need a university for them, and people like Habermas are just clouding the issue by trying to talk about it, okay? Now, it seems to me this kind of view about universities, which, again, as I'm saying, does have root in the Enlightenment, the way the Enlightenment was thinking about universities, is one that has become increasingly powerful in the post-Cold War era. Because remember, Lyotard's writing in 1979, the Cold War's still going on. But by 1989, right, we start to get a situation where what he's talking about isn't just some kind of, you know, theoretical radicalism, but it's something that looks like, from an institutional standpoint, makes a lot of sense. And the way you see it then reinvented during that period, in the 1989 and after, is in terms of this business, and those of you who like to follow Brussels speak, you know, all you EU wannabes. I'm sure there's some future commissioners just sitting here in this room. There's this stuff about the new production of knowledge. You may have heard about the new production. Whenever, you know, it's like new, it's like the 5-year plan, right? The new production of knowledge. And this is a book I'm referring to, came out in 1994. A lot of different authors. The main ones are Michael Gibbons, until recently was the president of the Association of Commonwealth Universities. I guess the theoretical light behind it is Helga Novotny, who used to be at the University of Vienna and is now in Zurich, I believe. And there are also other people who are involved from different countries. What this book argues, this is the book that introduces this famous or notorious distinction between mode one, mode two knowledge production. And this is, in terms of the whole, what the, you know, the whole science policy speak in Brussels is, it's all about this. It's as much, it's had a lot of cachet being exported to other parts of the world, especially ones where there are weakened university systems. So, for example, Japan. Okay, you know, in other words, where there's been a lot of neoliberalization of what was previously a national university system. I say that because one place where this whole way of thinking about things has not really taken root is the United States. Because if you look at the world stage, right, the United States has a pretty well-funded, pretty well-insulated university system by world standards. Of course, there are people always complaining, and that's a lot, and a lot has to do with the fact that there's a very strong sense of accountability in the United States between state legislatures and boards of trustees and academics. So there's always a lot of this kind of, you know, mutual suspicion. But in terms of the actual money floating around, it's quite a lot. And that's why, of course, if you're a foreign student, you know, non-American, thinking about a place to do a PhD, the United States is a great place because they give all, you know, they give a few, even mediocre departments will give a few scholarships to people who are good enough regardless of where they come from. No preferential treatment for natives. I mean, I used to teach at a place called Virginia Tech, which has the biggest PhD program in science studies in the United States, and it's, you know, and it's, as the tech name indicates, is it's based on engineering. For the 4 years that I was there, they gave out these PhD scholarships for students who wanted to study physics and engineering, and 75% of the students were students who came from East Asia who got these things. This led to enormous investigations by the Virginia State Legislature, because it's the taxpayers of Virginia who fund Virginia Tech. It's a public university. But at the end, Virginia Tech got its way, and that's been typically the case. Right, where the taxpayers of a given state are in fact subsidizing these people. And the idea is, of course, you know, we get these guys, they're going to be very well trained, they're very smart, you know, and they'll be good, right? They might stick around and they bear us and just stay in the United States, of course, right? So it's not a bad investment from that standpoint. And that's often how it gets sold, right? So the thing is that this kind of view of the university having to sort of change and adapt and become something different, that the people in the mode two knowledge, mode one, mode two discussion, it's pretty much outside of the United States. Universities pretty much can still call their own shots in the United States. One of the things that also helps in the United States, and this is maybe a word to the wise in Britain here, is the United States has a remarkably wide ecology for higher education. So in other words, there is no pretense that everybody's got to be measuring up to the same standard. Now, that has a lot to do with the fact that higher education in the United States was founded by private interest, and the state only got involved later. So that the strongest universities in the United States to this day tend to be private ones, and often the oldest ones. The Ivy League schools, which were founded by dissident Protestants from this country, they're still the strongest ones. And the other private universities tend to be very strong academically as well. And what that does is, those private universities, they're just setting policy for themselves. And so then other universities come in, and they sort of define themselves in relation to the others to set their own policy. And so there's quite a lot of autonomy even given to public universities with regard to how they raise funds and what they do and so forth. So what you end up getting, if you look at the whole American scene where you've got 2,500, 3,000 institutions of higher education, right, is that you're getting everything on the waterfront from Harvard, right, which, you know, has an endowment the size of the top. Well, I think it's like the lowest 50 countries in the world. And you have, you know, a sort of community college you wouldn't send your dog to, right? I mean, you've got everything. You've got something for everyone there. And all of them can make money. All of them can survive in these market environments that they've managed to carve out for themselves. So there isn't some crisis of people saying, oh, half of America's universities are going to have to close next year because they can't meet their budgets, the kind of thing you see every week in the Times Higher, right? You don't see that in the United States. But in the rest of the world, you do see that. Because in the rest of the world, right, most of the countries that have decently sized university systems have had very strong state input through taxation and so forth. And as that withdraws, and as universities are being forced, as it were, to justify themselves in a much more bottom-line level, namely, we're not just going to presume that you're good things to have around, you actually have to show what you're delivering to us, right, then the crisis starts. And it's under those circumstances that this mode one, mode two thing I've been talking about from Brussels makes a lot of sense. So what's mode 1, mode 2? Just like get that on the table. Mode 1 is some kind of negatively tinged view of academic work. See, because one of the things about this whole mode 1, mode 2 argument, which, and it connects up very much with my interest in Thomas Kuhn, which was mentioned earlier, is the university as an institution doesn't really get discussed in any of this stuff. What you get as mode 1 is something like a discipline or a paradigm. Okay? So in other words, and if you know about Kuhn's work, right, the idea is you've got some autonomous problem-solving unit, right, which has a kind of overarching theory, has a kind of set of methods that's appropriate to the theory, and that generates then a set of problems. And typically you're able to launch one of these things once some guys come along and has actually shown how you can already, you know, you can solve certain problems by going this way. So Isaac Newton comes along, writes Principia Mathematica, shows how if you only have the three laws of motion and the principle of gravity, you can explain all the motions of the planets. That's pretty neat. Okay, maybe we can use that to explain all other kinds of physical motion. That gives you the next 200 years of physics. This is Kuhn's story, okay? Now, the thing that's very important about this is that the story is self-contained, right? In other words, it's the knowledge producers, the physicists in this case, setting out the agenda, solving the problems, and making the judgments themselves about what's good and what's bad, okay? There is no concern here about whether physics relates to other forms of knowledge, let alone other academic disciplines. So in other words, the way we're imagining mode one knowledge production is not like a department or a discipline in a larger university or knowledge structure, but rather as, you know, something unto itself. I mean, one of the things when I did the book on Kuhn that I was looking for, especially when I started going into the archives and looking at his work, was he never discusses university in his book. Right? There's no. I mean, people kind of read. They think, "Oh, Kuhn must be talking about a discipline in the sense that we understand it as a university," but it's not clear. It's never explicit. It's not clear what the sociological vehicles are for this thing called a paradigm. And one of the things that Kuhn says in some of the letters is he's not sure the university is really a good place for it because universities, and he considers it a bad thing, right, forces people in different subjects to think about how they relate to each other, often because they have to design curriculum. Right, so you imagine you got a a large amorphous department like biology, for example. Right, it's a million things happening in biology these days, but still a lot of it is housed all within the same department. And then there's a curriculum committee in that department, and the curriculum committee is going to say, okay, what bits of all these different things you guys are doing in biology belongs at part as a common curriculum. And this is where everybody it becomes a nightmare, right? Because then people have to say, my God. I know how to justify my work when I'm publishing in my wonderful peer-reviewed journals that only three people read. I know how to justify my work that way. But how do I justify my work when I'm talking to guys who claim to be in the same discipline but are working with completely different methods, with different theories, maybe even a different scale and scope of phenomena? That's hard. Okay? Now, for me, that's where the action is when it comes to knowledge. And this is where teaching becomes so important. Because it's only in something like the curriculum committee, in the process of curriculum design, that you actually have some kind of practical, concrete opportunity to say, what does all this knowledge have to do with each other? You have to consolidate it. Why do you have to consolidate it? Because you've got a target in mind. You've got students whose minds you've got to fill with this stuff, and students' minds are finite, as we know all too well. And you just cannot put everything into it. Right? You've got a limited number of weeks, you've got limited intellects, right, with limited attention spans. So what is it that you're doing in your wonderful research that's really so important? And if the answer is nothing, then you're in trouble, at least by that way of judging things. But for Kuhn, for a paradigm, for mode one knowledge production, you never ask that question. You never ask, what is the relevance or the significance of this knowledge for the larger project of knowledge? All you wonder is this actually solving problems that my paradigm has set for me? Is it responding to issues that other guys who write in these peer-reviewed journals I'm so enamored with, are they, you know, would they respect what I'm doing? And that's the terrain. It's that limited. Now, not surprisingly, if it is that limited, if mode one is the characterization you give of academic knowledge production, mode two looks like heaven. Right? Because mode two is relevance. right? Relevance. It's relevant knowledge, not just this kind of self-contained, navel-gazing nonsense that's written in language nobody understands. It's relevance. It's socially relevant. It's the land of users and beneficiaries, right? You know, it's where money talks and academics jump, right? Relevance. We can see it. We see smiling faces. We see larger purses, right? And so we can show we're doing something. Okay. Now, from my standpoint, looking at this as someone who's trying to defend the university, we seem to have made some major leap here, right? We have gone, on the one hand, from mode one, navel-gazing knowledge production a la Thomas Kuhn paradigms, all the way over to relevance in terms of letting the world dictate our agenda. Okay? Whatever happened to the university? Whatever happened to the business of trying to make the knowledge relevant to other knowledge producers, especially in the context of something like designing a curriculum, where you have to think about what is it that I'm doing that is relevant to anyone who wants to have some kind of general liberal education? You know, in other words, education for being a citizen, for functioning in an intelligent, progressive kind of way. In some sense, what I'm doing, no matter how esoteric it is, ought to be contributing to that. And obviously, the curriculum kind of forces you to kind of think in those terms. What is it? You know, how can I distill it? How can I present it? But that whole aspect of things disappears. And one of the reasons it disappears is because in the Mode 2 knowledge production, the way in which knowledge is distributed, right, is through the clients, right? And the way in which teaching is conceived is as glorified vocational training, right? So in other words, you want the teaching to be oriented to where the jobs are, and you want a better match. And one of the places where you really see this happening, because you might think humanities and social sciences might be the most vulnerable places, but this is not true, because no matter how esoteric we may think we are never nearly as esoteric as the natural scientists are, okay? And it's the natural science faculties that really get hit with this kind of issue very hard. Because what you basically have is you have very old school kind of natural science guys who are thinking a bit like Thomas Kuhn, right? And saying, look, you know, physics, we've laid out these problems. They're very precise problems. You know, we've got Einstein, you know, legitimizing us and all the rest of it. And we want to continue pursuing this kind of thing. And you, meanwhile, you got some corporate guys saying, you know, we don't really need more people working on string theory. You know, we really don't need people who are going to be swinging a couple of neutrons in a particle accelerator. We don't really need that. We need some guys in solid-state physics. We need some people moving into nanotechnology, whatever that is, right? That's what we need. We need stuff that is going to provide the basis for the next wave of the economy. And you physicists, the problem with you physicists is because you are so theoretically driven, hidebound paradigm mongers, your people are just not capable of functioning in the appropriate kind of environment. And this is, in fact, I mean, indeed. I mean, if you look at the physics PhDs, and physics is a subject doing a lot better than chemistry in all this. This is why chemistry has to reinvent itself as nanotechnology. But physics was traditionally doing, you know, physics is a subject that, in fact, you know, has really suffered because physics has tried to hold the line as being a kind of pure academic subject. And what you end up getting is that the likelihood of you with a PhD in physics getting a job in physics is about the same as you as a PhD in art history getting a job in art history. Okay, it's about 30%. And what happens with these PhDs in physics who don't go into physics? Well, they don't necessarily go into nanotechnology or try to re-hone their skills. They actually go to the city, right, and become big bankers and stockbrokers and systems analysts because of the kind of just the basic quantitative methodological skills they will have learned as physicists. So in other words, they don't play ball with the industrialists at that level in terms of, as it were, twisting the research agenda. They just take their skills and go elsewhere. So they just drop out of the science market altogether. Okay, and so there's this massive withdrawal of physics talent from science that's taking place at the moment. And so there's a real battle taking place here in the natural sciences. So you shouldn't think the natural sciences are really, I mean, in one sense they are benefiting in the sense that, you know, from the standpoint of the money, yes, the money moves there, but there are some real issues about how you train people and whether there's and what's happening to the integrity of these disciplines, right, as people are shifting the research projects. Because one of the problems is, you might say, Well, what's wrong with physicists learning to work in interdisciplinary contexts? Well, in a sense, nothing is wrong with that. The problem is, what's going to happen once the research is produced from these kinds of interactions? Right? We now, there's this fashionable phrase called the triple helix, right, which is the state, universities, and industry, you know, the kind of research projects that are sort of cooked up by this trio in the cauldron, which of course the Germans had at the beginning of the century with the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, which are now the Max Planck Institutes, but they've been and reinvented this idea. Well, the thing about these things is it's not clear that the knowledge produced in this fashion through in this kind of hybrid way with many disciplines and many clients actually ends up feeding back into the academic structure in some straightforward way so that it can become knowledge that's generally available for everyone. And this is where issues of intellectual property come in, right? And what exactly, you know, who gets the first say over whether you publicize your work and stuff like this. And that's really the main problem as far as I can see. I am a big defender of interdisciplinary work. But the problem with a lot of the interdisciplinary work that's happening now is it's happening in a situation where the university really is not in control of the show, where the university is just one partner among many, and as a result has to negotiate the terms under which this knowledge that's produced is distributed. And one of the consequences is it's not obvious how this will feed back into the curriculum, that is to say, back into the general body of knowledge that can then be disseminated to the society at large. That is the big problem with a lot of this stuff. And it's not just because of intellectual property regimes, though that does matter. There's also the issue of the motivation of the people who are engaged in this kind of work. Okay? We are producing, in this mode 2 world that we're in, we're producing a scientist, and I'm going to use the word scientist in the kind of, you know, sort of as a man of Wissenschaft, woman of Wissenschaft, right? I don't mean just natural scientist. A person who, in a sense, doesn't feel an obligation once they've produced the knowledge to teach it. Okay? Because that was very much part of the sort of classical idea. I mean, and it was part of what was attached to the idea of producing knowledge as a form of enlightenment. Because after all, you're not exactly enlightening a lot of people if all you do when you produce knowledge is either turn it over to intellectual property office or publish it in a journal that 3 people read. You're not exactly contributing to the project of enlightenment here, so don't fool yourself. Okay? The project of enlightenment occurs, right, through, of course, the public function, if you give public lectures and all that kind of stuff. But even if you don't do that, the fact that you've got this captive audience of students, right, you have this obligation, and this is where the curriculum committee comes in again, where you have to consider, what is it that I am doing in my research, in the cutting edge, that is in fact relevant to put forward to all those students out there so they can do whatever they will do with it. That sense of obligation, which has traditionally underwritten academic tenure, the idea of having a sort of protected life post in academia, that is disappearing. That is disappearing. So that, and one of the ways, of course, it's disappearing is by the disappearance of tenurable posts. So, you know, as an old professor retires, right, in its place arises, you know, 3-year renewable contracts, research contracts, teaching contracts, right? Sometimes my university tries to fiddle things a bit because they have a kind of mild interest in career development of young academics, and what they try to do is they try to make sure that a guy who's just been hired to research might do a little teaching, you know, so that if he wants to be a real academic, he might actually have the skills to do it. Okay, but this is often seen as a burden, and what you end up doing is you end up creating these people who think that really the mark of distinction, the way to go, is to just be on these endless research contracts, right? And that research is the name of the game, and if you've got to teach, you've somehow failed. You know, you've been sent back to the classroom, but it's, you know, being sent to the sidelines or something, okay? And this is ruining the whole ethic. The whole academic ethic that the university is founded on. And obviously it's for this reason that a lot of younger people, when you talk to them about stuff like tenure and the unity of teaching of research and all of this stuff, they just think of all that old academic deadwood professors right? What are they doing just taking up space? I can't wait till they retire, right? And the younger generation has gotten very much into the kind of neoliberal mold of thinking, hey, look, I have to prove myself every 3 years. I've got to produce stuff. Otherwise, I don't get my next job. I'm doing perfectly well under this regime. Everybody ought to be like this. You know, and maybe universities aren't the place for me. Maybe I ought to go to a research park. You know, and what are universities for anyway? And maybe those knowledge managers out there are right to want to disaggregate the university into separate units, each of which just, some of them just teach, some of them just do research. What's wrong with that? After all, universities are institutions that are what, 800, 700 years old? I mean, sure, back in those primitive days of the Middle Ages, you know, it may be that one institution could serve all those functions at once, right? But nowadays, in our large, diversified, complex, ever-evolving, self-organizing, blah, 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 multi-adaptive society, right, we can't have these sorts of institutions, right? They're not sufficiently open or porous or whatever the buzzword is, right, to be able to accommodate to the changing environmental conditions, right? You know, this is kind of the idea of knowledge production is a kind of amoeba-like process, and this is progress, right? Amoeba is kind of our mascot. Forget about human beings. So the thing is that for a lot of people in the younger generation, when they think about the university as an integral institution, you know, they don't have the historical perspective. All they see are a lot of old guys who look like they're past past a sell-by date. And so what is there to defend? Okay. So we're really quite in quite a mess here. Now, let me tell you what the bright side of the story is, and then I'm gonna shut up and maybe more of it will come out in the questions. One of the things that's happening, and I mentioned this earlier, is that the state is withdrawing if not completely withdrawing, is certainly providing incentives for universities not to rely on state funding. Okay, and this is happening across the world, with the exception of the United States, perhaps. And universities are responding to this. Now, this is happening in the context of a larger development in political economy, which we would normally identify as the retreat of the welfare state. Okay, where private interests have to provide more and more of the sorts of things the state in the past have had to provide. We're hearing a lot about pensions recently, for example. Now, the interesting thing about all this, of course, is as the state has been withdrawing from various kinds of social functions, who exactly is picking up the slack, right? What other institutions are picking up the slack? Now, one of the things that I've been noticing in my travels around the world is that universities are picking up the slack. In other words, in certain respects, universities are becoming more state-like. Okay? So universities, for example, might be running hospital systems, healthcare systems. Right? I mean, there is a historic precedent for that kind of thing. I mean, after all, universities were responsible for setting the standards for the certification of medical schools when they were pretty much all just determined by who, you know, on a purely free market basis at the turn of the last century. Universities set up certification programs to accredit schools as actually being able to turn out competent doctors. So there's always been that. And also there's been the university training hospitals, which often would take in patients and actually heal them or treat them, sometimes experiment on them, sometimes all at once. So that at the same time you can govern them more effectively and you can also get some knowledge on the side. Now, this is happening more and more, okay? This is happening more and more. I spent last year one term at UCLA, which is a university very much, has some similar characteristics to Warwick, in that 75, this is a public university officially, just like Warwick is supposedly a public university, 75% of its income is private. Okay? 75% of the income is private. And one of the things that that UCLA, which has this massive budget, it's like one of the 10 richest universities in America, and it's just a branch campus of the University of California, is that it's basically taken over the governance of the Southern California health system. It monitors all the hospitals, it keeps the standards, and this is basically because you know, Los Angeles County and all the other counties down in that part of the United States are just got stretched budgets, most of which are going to police, which is the stuff that voters always were willing to pay taxes for, is police. But anything else, I don't know, education, health, those are secondary items. And so the thing is, where does this all go? Well, the universities pick this up, okay? And the universities, in fact, provide health care and often reproduce welfare schemes, start entering into contracts with employers and stuff like this. And of course, this is, you know, this is not just pure selflessness. Of course, this is feeding into the medical research agenda. It is not by accident that, you know, UCLA has one of the most powerful research, medical research fronts in the world. And where do you suppose the data is coming from? It's coming from all those grateful citizens in Southern California. Okay? And the thing is, this is getting to be characteristic where universities are picking up governance functions left over by the state and in a way trying to mold them around to their own knowledge-producing agendas. I'm saying this in a very stark, kind of almost Foucauldian sort of way, just to sort of, because of course they don't talk like this, right? This is part of a way of, because, you know, universities historically have had very checkered relationships with the cities and the regions and where they're located, right? Because very often they're seen, especially, I mean, Warwick has this problem, you know, ignoring Coventry. Easy to do, perhaps, but not necessarily best in terms of, and this is going to be on tape, not necessarily the best thing from the standpoint of public relations, okay? So here's an opportunity where the universities are picking up governance functions, which the state has kind of dropped the ball on, and in fact, ingratiating itself with the community this way. And it has had that kind of effect. I mean, in the 3-4 months I was at UCLA, I was following the way it was being portrayed in the newspapers and the radio and stuff like that, and it was really like an alternative state apparatus. And because it was taking care of primarily the welfare function, and it wasn't involved in police, and as you know, Los Angeles is not the greatest place in the world for police, that, in fact, it had a very positive image. Okay? It had a very positive image. And if you look at places like Harvard and MIT, which are both in the same city, Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is a very sort of run-down industrial city, I mean, you wouldn't know there was a government in Cambridge, Massachusetts, because the police cars have the logos of Harvard and MIT on them. You know, just like you have security patrols on all university campuses, the ones at Harvard and MIT, because the faculty live all over the city, of course, and all the research associates and everything, you have to be policing the whole city in order to make sure all of your staff is okay. So they basically replace the police force. Okay? I mean, now, this does cause problems. Just like whenever the state does something to defend citizens, it causes problems as well. And all of these universities have been involved in major lawsuits and all kinds of political wrangles. And of course, because universities generally have a sort of not-for-profit status, right, the way in which they invest their money becomes a greater public concern. And so all these issues are starting to bubble up in the way they haven't before. But what I want to say as the positive side of this is that that universities aren't necessarily just rolling over on this. They are not just necessarily disaggregating. They are not just becoming multi-service providers. But they are, in fact, in a way, performing, in many respects, some of the consolidating functions that the state has done historically, and which is now, as the welfare state has become too bloated, has been retreating from doing. The universities, at least the ones that have been wealthy enough, have been picking up the slack on this. And my view about this is I actually think this is going to happen more and more in the future. And that, in fact, and one of the things I recommend at the end of this paper with regard to the context of UNESCO is that the way we measure the productivity and the inputs and outputs of universities, the way we give a kind of a sort of balance sheet for the university, we should think about it more like the way we think about states in terms of what we're comparing to. So, you know, we're always hearing like all this stuff I was saying about Harvard having an income level that's the same as the 50 poorest countries in the world put together or something. Well, let's take that seriously. Harvard's certainly intervening around the world in all kinds of ways with development programs and stuff like that, the tunes of millions and millions of dollars. So it's actually intervening kind of in a way a country with a very substantial development policy would. So why not treat universities more in that fashion in terms of the way in which we evaluate their performance and the way in which we actually keep track of what they're doing and in terms of the way in which we justify their value? Okay. Because I think at the moment, we're very, you know, at the very least, we are very unimaginative about the way in which we account for the value that universities produce. You know, especially as long as we're looking at just the numbers of papers produced, or the numbers of times these things are cited, or number of patents, and all this nonsense, right? We're just not focusing on where, on the whole consolidated picture of the university, and the emerging role that I see it's playing, namely as a substitute for the state. And with that, I will stop and take questions. Thank you for your indulgence.
Questions?
Don't all jump in.
Well, I could start if you want. We were just by coincidence, we were reading Bill Redding's book this morning.
Oh, yeah, The University in Ruins.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you'd anticipated what he would say to you is that you're using a nostalgic position to try to defend the university. And then I guess what I'd say to you is that I'm just wondering about this trying to develop a measurement for the university based on the state, given the state's poor record of being able to defend its output as well, especially the welfare.
Well, I actually don't think the welfare state has such a poor record, to be perfectly honest. I think that's one. I mean, I think there's a sense in which we're sort of sent on the we're set on the back foot a little too easily on these sorts of matters. First of all, let me get to the business about the nostalgic image. Look, almost any image that is likely to authorize any kind of action we do is going to have some kind of historical pedigree to it. It's pretty unlikely that something just cooked out of the blue is going to be commanding much authority, and I guess the fact that an image has a historical basis for it is not itself a liability, especially if you try to think of ways of how that could be used as a critique of the sort of drift of what seems to be the dominant position now, which is to sort of suppose that the university is sort of, you know, it's sort of past its sell-by date. Its disaggregation is kind of a natural process in a way, and that in some sense the welfare state was artificially protecting the university, which I think sometimes people also believe. So the fact that this is an image that originates in the early 19th century is not necessarily very negative to me, especially because we still do run universities very often on these principles of being concerned about how research and teaching relate to each other. I mean, it's not like this issue doesn't have any kind of concrete basis in our practices today. It's just that these practices aren't valued very highly. So when we do talk about the curriculum committee and so forth, and we talk about people who are worried about, you know, like people who fuss with their course outlines, we usually think these people should, you know, they have too much time on their hands, right? See, this is a mistake, but it's very common. You know, they said, shouldn't you be out there doing some esoteric research or getting a grant or something like that? Don't worry about whether, you know, you've assigned the right books and that the students are going to read the stuff. Come on, you know? This is the 21st century. You know, it seems to me this I think is mistaken, but it's mistaken because we're not valuing sufficiently well something we're still doing, right? Now, with regard, so this is about the state's track record. My main point here is I think We have a problem with how to evaluate universities. And one of the reasons why I think we're stuck with things, I mean, the research assessment exercise and the teaching quality assessment, these two things are diabolical together because they obviously pull the university apart in opposite directions. They really encourage, because there's no sense with these two types of performance indicators how they relate to each other. It's as if you're, it's almost like only a physical accident we're going to the same place to do each exercise, because the kinds of things we're looking at have nothing to do with each other. Now, this seems to me really, this is wrong. And the fact that universities have allowed this to happen, they haven't kind of, as it were, taken more control over the situation, try to define their own metrics. I think this is a complete disaster and has to be rectified. Okay, and in a sense, this is kind of, as it were, the main problem. And my view about that, how do you rectify it, is, well, the first thing to do is to try to come up with some measures that do relate research and teaching, and actually do start to look at the way, you know, try to chart the way in which stuff that's happening on the research frontier get into the syllabus, you know, whether certain subjects are better than others in doing this, and have some way of evaluating this and encouraging this, okay? I'll give you an example. In the United States, in 1990, the Carnegie Foundation for Teaching did a report called Scholarship Reconsidered. And this was in light of the fact that already, you know, so 1990s, just at the end of the Cold War, a lot of smaller colleges, traditional liberal arts colleges, which have been teaching oriented and not really big on the research frontier, had been increasingly under pressure to evaluate faculty as if they were at the, you know, top doctoral level institutions, that they have to be publishing a lot all the time and everything. And this was really a strain on the academic culture of these little places. Okay. And so what the Carnegie Foundation did was did a survey about what people, how did people think, first of all, did they think as academics they were engaged in some kind of scholarship or research? And second of all, how did they conceptualize it? Because in a sense, you know, they didn't take it for granted that, that the way the answer to the question is by the papers I write and publish or by the grants I get, right? And in fact, most of these people, outside of the context of the major doctoral granting institutions, most of these people thought about their research and scholarship as something that was manifested primarily in their teaching. And so the and what this led the Carnegie Foundation to recommend was that in fact, rather than try to encourage everybody to publish all the time and giving them time off to publish and all this, I mean, what one should do is one should reward people who go to conferences to participate if they are able to show afterward that in fact what they have learned at this conference through the interactions, through the meeting of people, through the subsequent reading that they do, enables them to revamp the curriculum. So they have a more up-to-date curriculum that's teaching them more progressive stuff and so forth. This is smart. This is a smart idea, okay? And what it does is, because I know, you know, there's a sense in which we think we're doing people a favor when we give them time off to write articles and things rather than teach, but often the stuff that's produced is very artificial. It's not really the primary medium in which, you know, and it's not because these people have stopped thinking either. It's just that we are not sufficiently appreciative of the multiple ways in which new research can be concretized. And this is where going back to the curriculum, it seems to me, is a very valuable kind of suggestion. But obviously, this is not going to be something Tony Blair is going to be suggesting. This is going to be something that's going to have to come from some kind of, you know, consolidated thinking on the part of the representatives of higher education, who come up with, as it were, with an alternative strategy for self-evaluation. And that's what we haven't had.
Okay, just adding one quick thing on that. Just in around this question of nostalgia,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. It has to start as some kind of historical project. But if you think about, I suppose what I would like to think more about is what are the limits that we also are taking with us from that history? Because, for instance, you know, it's basic. The people who crush the guy from Skidmore or Smith, who want to be teachers,
mm-hmm.
are the people at Harvard.
Yeah.
If they're the people who are still protected in that older Humboldtian idea of the university, they're the ones who crush these poor people when they want to step forward and say, teaching's important and my scholarship is in there. So, and that seems to me the problem of the historical model, is that the historical model was a pretty limited model.
Well, I think what happened, Harvard, in a way, Harvard has a very checkered track record on this, because as you may know, maybe people here don't know, the people who win the teaching awards at Harvard never get tenure, right? Right. I mean, Harvard has this very funny way of hiring people, which in a way reinforces the problem. Harvard never promotes its own people to full professor. Rather, other places do it first, and then Harvard cherry picks them. And as for the people who do most of the teaching, the untenured people, those guys are really good. They're working with all the students on the front line. They get teaching awards, but they don't get promoted. They get sent somewhere else. Okay, so Harvard just keeps the luminaries, right? So you end up having demonstrated in Harvard a real distinction between research and teaching, right? You're right. You're absolutely right about that. There's a problem with Harvard being a standard bearer on this kind of thing. I actually thought, okay, that's true. There are certain institutions that are problematic this way. But I do think it's kind of in the interest of the higher education community as a whole. If we're talking about, you know, something that, you know, that let's say all the vice chancellors or something like this could perhaps agree on. Because I cannot confess to being able to fathom the minds of vice chancellors, but I have a hard time believing that they actually want things going the way they are, where it looks like we're going to end up in a system where we're going to have a caste system, right, of the research active universities, maybe 30 of them, right, and then another 60 or 70 that are teaching mills. You know, I mean, and I think that's a real. I can't believe that the people, our leaders in higher education, want to embrace what seems to be the inevitability if we go down the route we're going. But nothing's going to change if there isn't some kind of definitive counter-proposal that is very systematic, that gets everybody on board, not just the elites and not just the old polytechnics, but gets everyone on board. And that's hard, because universities, you know, they do not act well collectively. I mean, that's one thing about, you know.
Just to kind of pick up maybe a little bit on Stefano's point. I liked the idea of the curriculum as relevant, but there was a couple of things about it, I suppose. I mean, in some ways, what struck me about your talk was that you kind of talk about Kuhn's, you know, that mode one is a very self-contained kind of thing, which is not how you would see it. But I was it just struck me maybe that you kind of see the university, the academy maybe, is quite a self-contained thing. You know, what struck me about the things you're talking about is, you know, curriculum is relevant is us saying this is what's important, this is what we make as a kind of to have relevant or value. But in a strange way, lots of other professions have also come under that kind of, you know, for the want of a better expression for them, you know, the doctors, the kind of lawyers, they've all come under these kind of pressures. So, you know, what it's about is a kind of instigation of some sort of market-led relevance across the board. And to pick up on Stefano's point, what you kind of notice about those other areas is, of course, that they are divided, you know. Large law firms are very different from small law firms. Lawyers don't have the same interest in the same way as your vice chancellors don't have the same interest with people in the polys, or where, you know, whatever it might be. I'm just wondering if you do present too homogenous a view of what's going on in the academy, and all our interests are actually maybe quite different.
Okay, there are several issues here. One is, of course, what exactly is the domain that I'm talking about? Because, of course, as things get called universities, right, that didn't start life as universities, that does change the issue. And, in fact, my understanding is that one of the reasons why governments have been inclined to want to call all kinds of institutions like polytechnics and teachers' colleges and things like that universities is to gain some leverage against the sort of old kind of protectors of the ideal classical university model. Because if you've got, in Britain, whatever, 100 institutions, you know, only, whatever, 30 or 40 of which are old universities, right, then, you know, if you're going to think about how we're going to consolidate and get some kind of collective opinion on the part of vice chancellors, it's not going to happen because the interests are, in fact, different. And so you might say that's a very clever kind of government strategy to make everything a university, makes it impossible to get any kind of agreement among these guys because they're really coming from many different places. I can see that. That's a real issue. And in fact, that was part of the strategy behind de Gaulle creating lots of new universities in France in the 1960s. And it's one of the things that, in fact, Lyotard remarks on in the Postmodern Condition. Again, because, you know, as you know, France traditionally had this very pyramidal elite academic structure, and de Gaulle just broke that by creating millions of universities all over the place. Okay, so yeah, you have a good point there. I do think, though. Yeah, this is going to be one of these things where it's a principled thing, and it's not clear who's going. You know, maybe at the end of the day, there will be some division in the ranks. But I do think one way in which universities are different from the liberal professions is that the liberal professions traditionally have been client-oriented. You know, even though they have set their own standards and they have a guild-like structure and all that, I don't want to deny that, of course. But nevertheless. They are client-based by definition, and there has always been competition among schools of doctors and schools of lawyers and things of that kind. And there isn't the kind of that kind of a profession isn't sort of set up in a way to make one think in terms of what is it that everyone should know, what is it that every, you know. Whereas universities do have that kind of remit, right? And so there is a difference between what an academic does and what a doctor and a lawyer does. Because an academic is not obviously client-based, right? Not an obviously, I mean, maybe nowadays it's becoming client-based with Mode 2 knowledge expression, but it's not a natural self-description, it seems to me. There was another issue that you raised that I wanted to talk about. And it was related to something you were saying, too.
Is it the fact that all our interests...
Well, no, there's that, yeah, but there was something... maybe I'll remember it. Why don't we move on and maybe I'll remember.
Okay?
Yeah, because I don't want to, like, just dead air here until we figure it out.
Yeah.
Anne.
Yeah, I've got a fairly incoherent point to make. But, I mean, what I liked about your argument was that you were focusing on the institutionalization of knowledge practices. Now, I was thinking, about this whole issue of nostalgia. When you're talking about Harvard and the tiering of employment, I was thinking, well, actually, you know, Germany's very, very, very much like that. This sort of permanent insecurity.
Yeah.
So you can get a full professorship. But what Germany's also like, if you were saying Germany was the most successful, I think, at maintaining a Mode 1, Mode 2 distinction.
Mm-hmm.
I think very much so. But one of the reasons why it has been successful is, you know, if you're nostalgic and you want to hang on to things that you've got, then you also have to be incredibly elitist.
Mm, yeah.
And I think that shows in Germany,
okay,
where, you know, you are, from the very beginning, you describe yourself to others. If I was a pupil of Habermas, I was a...
So that could bring laughs from some people,
yeah,
but...
I was a pupil of so-and-so. You've got this elitist alliance bodies of knowledge. And then you've got elitist practices that enable those bodies of knowledge to reproduce and protect themselves. So it is that Professor Habermas who will basically sponsor your career and have a tremendous amount of influence on whether or not you do get a job. So that's my first point. So it's like, I kind of think maybe I'm nostalgic too, but the problem with nostalgia is it's also depends on elitism.
Can I answer that and then have you go to the next one?
Okay.
Because that does remind me that it is connected to what I was thinking of. And this has to do with the elitism, okay? And the way you put it was in terms of the academics dictating to the client. And this is where you drew the contrast with the liberal professions, right? That the academics kind of dictate what the canon is, what the curriculum is, and all this. And this seems to have a very kind of elitist conception. And that's true. I think historically that's kind of the way it begins. But the way it ends up getting, how should we say, democratized, is when one thinks of this as part of a reproduction process where you're imagining what, you know, that you're reproducing for a future where there are going to be new challenges, new things happening. And if you're thinking, you know, and so for example, and this was true of Germany, and certainly true, it's been true of the United States and other places that sort of took universities seriously as a nation-building project, was that it's not clear you want the same people generation after generation coming through the system. So in a sense, you'd be worried about the fact that next generation of students always seems to be taken from the same social classes as the last generation did, because in fact we're living in a different kind of world, different kinds of skills are required, different kinds of knowledge is required, right? There's always been kind of concern about that, right? And part of the motivation for creating new universities and expanding university numbers was that. And one way in which this process of sort of incorporating more people and, more importantly, different people into the university process was this business of the research feeding into the teaching, because the new research areas don't necessarily favor the same people as the old research areas did, and very often the people who are doing the new research are from different backgrounds. So, for example, if you look at you want to talk about a medium for upward social mobility in the 19th century, be a natural scientist, be a physicist or a chemist. Don't be a Latin scholar. I mean, those people tended to come from the elites. The humanists tended to come from the elites. But the people who were in the natural sciences were very often these kind of self-made guys who started off as apprentices with mechanics and stuff like that and then became professors. And as they managed to establish subjects, they were able to bring in other people as well, but often from their own social class. And so, for example, if you wanted to look at the original sites, the original academic sites for motivating socialist and communist thinking, in academia, it was from the natural science faculties in the early 20th century. Not the social science humanities faculties, but from the natural science faculties, where there was this issue of industrial labor, and the natural science had a much clearer sense of how their knowledge was feeding into other technological processes and stuff of that kind. So the business of the research frontier being, you know, as it were, looking toward the future, looking toward, as it were, a new generation that's going to lead the country in a new, more progressive direction, does have a kind of dynamizing quality that ends up, even if it ends up creating new elites, they're very often not drawn from the same classes as the old elites are from. And as the university's expanded, of course, more and more people get, in fact, incorporated into it. So, I mean, I think historically, that's why universities have historically been very good ways to actually engage in the upward social mobility. I mean, and of course, they're the fountainheads for things like affirmative action programs and stuff like that, which in my paper I'm very strongly endorsed as being very natural aspect, where you're always thinking about the future. What kind of people do you want representing the society in the future? Where are the new ideas going to come from? Universities are really the only places that are kind of, you might say, professionally in that business of creating that kind of dynamism. And I'm talking about the German classical 19th century university, not the kind of university that the Enlightenment people were reacting against. Because, I mean, you might say there are two old universities here, right? There is the 19th century style unity of teaching and research that I've been defending from Humboldt and the German tradition and so forth, which was very much involved with nation building and all that. But then there's that other university where the university was just reproducing mindlessly tradition, the kind of thing the Enlightenment guys were against, which was largely theologically based, largely just reproducing same old elites, where you had to, you know, have holy orders in order to become a faculty member, which is actually true in Oxford, Cambridge till the end of the 19th century. Right? So there's two separate issues here, you know, the two senses of old here, you might say, and mine is, as it were, the modern old, as opposed to the ancient old. But that's the connection between your, but you had a second question.
Well, that kind of picks off what you're saying, actually, because I was talking about the tiering of systems, in a sense that helps to maintain some kind of distinction between what goes on in different institutions.
Mm.
I think you were suggesting that France has that tiered system. I know Germany does. Because, you know, in social sciences, you've got your separate research institutes that look at the real world, whereas if you're Habermas, you just sit there in an armchair and think. And I was trying to think of a term to describe. I think it's been different in Britain. And I think the term that describes it, and it's been going on for a couple of hundred years now, is we've had a process of, let's call it, universitization. In the sense that there have always been these separate institutes springing up that have a radical alternative notion of knowledge, like natural philosophy. And then there was polytechnics, then there was new universities, post-Robbins. And what basically happened is all those alternative institutions have become universities. And maybe that's partly the root of some of the problems in Britain about how do you...
Well, see,
there are two
two kinds of models for let's say, greater inclusiveness, right, in the knowledge production system at the level of higher education. One is to take the classical university model, the one I've been defending, and actually expand the numbers and kinds of people who go into it, which is actually kind of what I prefer. The other way, you might say, it's kind of like the cheaper way, you might say, is to take things that already exist that are actually catering to different constituencies, like teachers' colleges and polytechnics, and call them universities.
Yes.
And as it were, give them the same status. Okay. Now, if you go the latter route, which is kind of the easier route from a political standpoint, right, what you create an enormous amount of confusion, and you also create a kind of divisiveness, because there is no shared history among these institutions. Right? If anything, the shared history is one of antagonism. Right, so the polytechnics, in a sense, get established, you know, from the cast-offs of the university, and it seems to me that's just diabolical, because what that does is that ends up creating the, in a way, it kind of discourages anyone from thinking that perhaps we can be sort of inclusive in one kind of institution, right? Because it just sort of gives the game up. It says, well, we're going to have these different institutions with these different kinds of people, and that's the end of the story. And I think that ends up defeating what the whole idea of the university was about, which was about creating a kind of universal knowledge at the end of the day. That was what it was about. And in fact, I think it had gone a long way toward doing that. in terms of inclusiveness and so forth, in terms of bringing in people from different economic and social backgrounds, bringing in women, bringing in minorities. I mean, in fact, the history of the university taken by itself actually has a pretty decent history of doing that. But now, in this period, we democratize across the board, and all that gets kind of wiped out, and we start thinking, well, you know, we need institutions that are tailored to the needs of different people, and we no longer have this pretense that we could have this kind of universally available knowledge. You see, so I think we're in a real diabolical situation, and unless academics themselves, the leaders of the academic community, unless we take control of the situation, it's just going to get more and more like this. And I really think sometimes academics just don't know what it is they want to defend about their institutions. And this goes back to the point about mode one, where people identify so strongly with their paradigms or their research programs or the people with whom they are in email contact with or whatever, but they don't identify with the university as an institution. And so if they think it's a kind of accident, it's like glorified car park. I go there, and that's why, academics, that's always what they're concerned about. They're concerned about nothing else but whether they have a good parking place. I can get... What?
A balcony.
Yeah. Can I get in? Can I get out? No muss, no fuss. Right? This is the academic's attitude toward a university. Right? No wonder, politicians have been able to make these kinds of inroads. Because we ourselves don't defend the institution very well. And in fact, I think most academics wouldn't be able to give you 250 decent words on why the university ought to be kept intact as an integral institution. And see, this is where our vice chancellors ought to be. This is what they ought to be doing. Because in a sense, they are the standard bearers for the institution. It may be regrettable that the individual academics are just focused on their own research, but then that's kind of what they get rewarded for, unfortunately. But the vice chancellor stands for the institution. It's like these corporate heads who end up, completely selling off the corporation and turning it into a glorified, sort of holding company, right? Where, it used to be called British Steel. What's it called? Chorus now? Right? It does everything but steel. Right? This is, the vice chancellors are sort of turning universities into things like this. Right? Where we'll have management training seminars, we'll have films showing, I'm thinking about Warwick, right? But like, where's the teaching happening? Where are those traditional university things happening? Well, see, vice chancellors are very important here. Right? And one of the things I recommend in this paper is that there needs to be special training for people who aspire to such positions. No. Because at the moment we have people who are great at selling soap becoming vice chancellors. Right, as if any organization of a certain scale and scope with, certain amount of input and output, right, it could be soap, it could be Lester, right? What's the difference, right? The content's different, but the form's the same. I mean, the problem is we're entering into an era where, university management is getting to be like that. So look at the Imperial College, right? The guy who merged GlaxoSmithKline is the head of Imperial College, and he wants to merge the whole University of London. Surprise, surprise. Okay? The head of the University of Wales used to be the head of R&D for Marconi PLC before that went under. I mean, you could go on and on. This is a scandal. But at the same time, I don't believe in the old-fashioned idea that a vice chancellor is just somebody who ought to be promoted from the ranks, because of course that's the classical idea, right? Where the person who becomes the head of the university is someone who started off as a faculty member and was a dean and then went up the ranks. I don't think that's really possible anymore. I think you really need someone who is specifically skilled in understanding what this entire organization is about and how it is distinctive with respect to other organizations with which it's competing and with which it has to deal with, so that the university retains its integrity. I think you need someone who can understand that. And it doesn't follow it'll be an ordinary academic, but it certainly doesn't follow it's going to be some CEO of a Fortune 500 company.
You sort of answered the question in a way. I was kind of wondering earlier on about your position which particular type of university are you defending, but you have said that it's the classical.
Yeah.
But then it doesn't have this classical model. It's like now we've got all these many different kinds of knowledge. Isn't that in contradiction with the old classical?
But the classical university, have often been the places where a lot of this new stuff ends up getting institutionalized, and certainly it's when it gets into such places that it becomes something that lasts a long time. that it actually has some kind of longevity. I mean, if you think about, I mean, I'm thinking about in the American context where there, where all of these wars over, changing the literary canon, the cultural canon, and putting non-traditional, subjects in there, these happen at the elite institutions. This is where all the action happens on all these matters. And when they start setting, and when they take action, everybody else follows after that. And historically, those institutions have been quite good on those kinds of matters. Okay? Not all the time, but they have been on balance, I would say. And certainly in terms of, especially the wealthier ones have been very good in terms of providing scholarships and stuff like that from people who would otherwise not be able to afford to go to such places. I think it requires, see, because one of the things, in order for a university to be willing to take, be able and willing to take risks, to sort of allow for new kinds of knowledge to take place, to allow for non-traditional types of students and non-traditional types of faculty to be involved, they have to have a certain kind of institutional security of their own. This is why it tends to happen at the top places, right? Because even if they blow it every now and then, right, they'll still survive. Right, whereas other places, which are much more sensitive to the market, right, where they really have to count how many clients they have in order to stay afloat, they can't afford to be radical. They may be shifting with the wind, and so in that very superficial sense, they may seem flexible and dynamic and all those wonderful things, but they're not very radical at all. They're just following market leaders. They're not taking any of the real substantial risks that the elite universities have been able to take.
Maybe I can maybe I can ask something. It's Derrida's week, I suppose.
Yeah.
So,
a moment of silence.
We have to close with some comment on this, given his affection for the university or for a certain type of idea of the university,
yeah,
which looks in a way similar to what you're arguing for here. For Derrida, of course, the this dynamic of the relationship between what the university might be and what it actually is absolutely central, right? The idea that the university is one of the institutions that ask questions of what conditions and of how we escape those conditions, those constraints. The university is the thing that tries to escape constraints, but the university always is within constraints. The university without condition is the thing the university hopes for, but is never possible, of course. This kind of dynamic of possibility and actuality, which is something you're doing, and I get a sense you're kind of arguing for something, but haven't really talked about places in which the thing you're arguing for might actually be taking place or, you know, actually be. And that's kind of partly interesting for us, because some of us have been in a staff meeting today where one of the things we're discussing is the redesign of our master's curriculum for all of our master's degrees in management, marketing, finance, and our MBA. And all of those curriculum redesigns involve, radicalizing the curriculum, you know, making it more critical, or, as you might put it, more like what you might teach in a university. to ask questions. And that relates, I suppose, to the second aspect of what's interesting in Derrida's analysis of the university, which is Derrida's attention, not just in his analysis of the university, but in other places as well, his attention to specificity, to the specific nature of the constraints. So Derrida doesn't give us a sweeping analysis of how the university is, and I think it's nice in a way that you're doing that or trying to do that. It's very useful to contextualise a lot of stuff. But Derrida is very specific to point to some really local things within the development of the teaching of philosophy in a specific location and so forth. And he's also able to, this is maybe a third point, he's also able to try to work with the traditional institution, the Haute Ecole, but also to invent the CIF, the International College for Philosophy, mm-hmm. which is a non-disciplinary, non-spatialized, almost non-existing kind of factory for the invention of ideas that can't be asked within universities. So both be very traditional and do this kind of radical thing. And that is, in a way, what the Center for Philosophy and Political Economy is doing here, you know, this kind of strange place where people are surrounded by rings. Well, yeah, in a kind of more humble way, I suppose. But in terms of what I see going on in other business schools, I don't think it is so kind of it's so little a vision, you know. I don't know other business schools where folks hang around reading Marx and talking about ideas and so forth. So, there was a question here, actually. Specificity of the, and it relates to what Jerry was asking about, that the specificity of what's going on. There are, like here in this kind of place, we have a sense that we are actually achieving some of the things you're arguing for. I'm just wondering how, if you want to talk about other places in which things are happening that you have some hope for, or other aspects of specificity that we're kind of missing sometimes in our
lives. Okay, well, one thing that was, one thing that motivated me to really defend kind of this kind of classical university was an experience I had about, I guess now about 5 or 6 years ago. I go to Sweden quite a lot, and Scandinavia generally, and there there is a this executive PhD idea floating around, but and a very interesting kind of version. This is being administered by Stockholm School of Economics, the Chalmers Institute of Technology in Gothenburg, and has the support of AstraZeneca and Ericsson and those big multinationals in Sweden. And the idea is to take middle management people who they've already invested in and who are going to stay with the company, and give them a couple of years off to actually do a PhD. Why? Well, because of certain kinds of intellectual skills that these guys at the multinationals thought that their managers were lacking, that actually doing a PhD would convey. And these skills, sustained critical thinking, being able to do research, you know, rather than just like read a magazine and say, oh, there's an idea, you know. I mean, stuff that we take for, you know, ability to synthesize material and to weigh the relative merits of things. I mean, stuff that, you know, would be very kind of taken for granted in a way, even at a more basic level than what we would teach at a research methods course, where the research methods course would sort of presuppose you have these basic skills. These would be things that you would be, in fact, trying to develop in these managers. And the reason being, the way in which corporations have been losing their sense of identity and their mission, where people are just sort of following each other's ideas around, they're taking in each other's laundry too much, right? So people say, oh, this company's doing, we've got to do it too. And so there's a loss of focus. There's no sense of what's important for the short term versus the long term, right? And so the whole idea of a corporate identity, a collective corporate memory, all of these things are just lost. No one thinks in these terms. They think in such short term terms. And so what happens then is that say, well, where can people pick up the desired skills that might actually give some intellectual ballast to what we're doing in our corporation? And I said, well, academics, don't they still critically think? Don't they still have these kind of long-term things? Don't they still synthesize and so forth? And so that's how they got in. So then they approached these universities to do it. And in Sweden, just like other places in Europe, right, there's a surplus production of PhDs coming from the traditional arts and sciences faculties who can't find jobs in academia. So they go into these executive PhD programs teaching these management guys with, you know, the skills that they themselves have trained quite classically academic way. And so I was part of this as kind of a visiting professor, kind of partially observing and partially participating. And it's really very interesting how this can really change the complexion. And actually, the big problem with it is that it always takes too long from a business standpoint, right? That's the big problem. So the PhDs end up being very short things. but the interesting thing is how it really does, when you take these kind of mental dispositions that academics have classically had, you know, which has been connected with the idea of being engaged in long-term projects and thinking critically about sources and things like that, it changes the whole character of how you conceptualize what your corporation is about, you know, and it kind of brings you back to fundamentals in a way. And that was kind of what the intent was of these corporate guys. And it was by watching this I thought, wow, there is something very, very interesting, very kind of profound here, because we so often think of, you know, we're often told academics have to pick up business values, right? We have to be more sensitive to market conditions. We have to think more in the short term. We can't be just pursuing things that we don't know what's ever going to happen to them. Whereas now, this is the reverse motion taking place. And having some quite positive effects. I mean, it's unfortunate that in academia we don't value the academic values very much. I mean, this is the big ironic part, right? That when these business guys would talk to me saying why they love funding this program, they have this very nostalgic, you might say, kind of view about what academics are like. And which is great in a way, because at our best we can be like that, right? But you could see immediately that there's just so many disincentives within academia to be pursuing the values that they think are the things that could really help their corporation, which are academic. Okay, and that led me to think, we have got to hold the line here, right, on the kinds of mental dispositions and values that we have classically stood for, which have been, in fact, done very well by society, and that nobody's defending them. And admittedly, they have to be defended in a new, updated kind of way. And so, like, when I wrote this book on knowledge management foundations, I actually spent some time talking about this initiative that I've just mentioned about Sweden, because I think that's kind of a new twist, in a way, for the value that, as it were, academic intellectual values aren't just valuable for academics, but they actually have greater societal value as values, not just in terms of the products you end up doing. It's not like, you know, but rather as frames of mind with which to conduct your business life, which is really, I think, the more profound thing that you want to preserve about academia. It's one thing to say academics are good at producing things business finds valuable, but it's another thing to say the whole academic turn of mind is a valuable thing. And that's the thing that I think is worth defending. And it was through that experience that I actually began to sort of become a much more explicit advocate of the university, you might say. Not that I was ever opposed to it. I spent my whole life at it. But the thing is that, but the idea of being very explicit in defending it, because because the lack of explicitness with which, you know, people deal with university, it hardly ever figures in the way people talk about things. You know, and so that's kind of in terms of the specificity of where I come from on this. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you, everybody. It was great.
Down to the marquee if anyone wants to join us.